That was the second movement of one of Beethoven's late quartets, Opus 130. It's barely 2 minutes long. It's part of a larger work that's considered monumental in the classical lexicon and in the Beethoven lexicon. And it was written and composed, it was composed within the last years, a couple of years of his life, when Beethoven was very sick and totally deaf. He never heard one note of that quartet. So why bring this up? Because although we, the listener, can be left to the joys of having our hearing filled with the sounds that hold on, with the sounds, and hold on to not a little awe at the man and circumstances from which produced this. For the composer, hearing sounds and bringing them together and creating music, as extraordinary as this is, was absolutely ordinary. He did that every day of his life, most every year, for his entire difficult life. This was absolutely ordinary. It was as mundane as having breakfast or taking a walk. I use this example while working with a client, part of whose dilemma was that they really saw no purpose in appreciating that, well, that she was the stable income in her family, which included her husband, 3 school-age children, several dogs, and a mortgage. And somehow, because she was doing what she should be doing, what was ordinary, she didn't feel connected to her own experience or own contribution. And that left her in a kind of fog, not really having any connection to the import of what she did, what she provided to the people closest to her, what she provided to her workplace, and found that she couldn't quite get anything out of it herself, looking at it that way. And if there was nobody present who could validate her externally, she could not really get a hold of it, have any substance to it. So there was nobody there from whom she could get a message that if there wasn't something out there that gave something of value, she couldn't have a affirming response or find joy or fun or pride inventing, musing, fancying, discovering, figuring, problem solving, and on and on and on. Because what she was doing, she labeled as ordinary, and ordinary couldn't find any meaning in it. I think that's part of a fiber that is hugely part of our culture and our societies and our families and schools and world, and is the source of an enormous amount of anxiety and depression. And I see those as very, very, very closely connected. And in fact, and I haven't necessarily read this anywhere, but just my own observation is that one of the functions of depressing is to keep a lot of anxiety at bay. Because the anxiety is so intolerable, I gotta let myself know that I'm not disturbed that I'm not feeling lost and at sea. I don't know, Jim, if you ever find that connection, but they very closely go together. And that could begin to change. One can begin to be aware of we can begin to be aware of our supports, both our internal supports and our external supports, when we take the risk of embracing our ordinary. It also means that we don't ordinarily, we're not comfortable with our own emotional experiences. We can't let ourselves, especially the difficult ones, especially being angry or being sad or being confused or embarrassed. And that we put an enormous amount of energy into finding ways to avoid or distract and letting go of the possibility of the value and the vitality of having an authentic experience. You know, many, many years ago, when things were going really crappy at home in my small little family, you know, my daughter was struggling terribly and my marriage was struggling terribly, I've shared with somebody that, well, a lot of times these days I feel really sad. And the first response was, do you think you should go on medication? So I kind of ended that conversation because I just didn't have the energy to explain it to them. But why shouldn't I feel sad? Things were really, really hard. And that was certainly one of the real experiences I was having, and yet we're so quick to feel that we need to run away from sad. The paradox there is you can't take one class of emotional experiences, one class of social experiences, one class of self experiences and damp it down and shrink it down and diminish it without dulling out everything else. So when you miss sad, you also miss joy. You also miss happy. When you miss feeling confused, you also miss the ingredients that go into invention and discovery. Because and creativity. Because creativity is not something that pops out whole. You know, like Athena from the head of Zeus, doesn't happen that way. A big part of it is not knowing and confusion and a little bit of chaos and raw materials that you need to have the courage and interest to sit with and start putting together to come out with something new on the other end. You know, at one time we really used to celebrate this. So much more than we do today. I used to listen to WFUV when they were city folk and had lots and lots of great tunes and music. And then they changed their whole format and brought in new people. And I listened to some of the songs that are there today, and the lyrics are bizarrely absurd. I mean, people are back to rhyming June and moon and, you know, what's happened to that inventive, creative, risk-taking kind of thing? Because what that comes out of what's ordinary in our in people's lives. For a musician, what's ordinary is to practice their music every day, to listen to other songs, to read poetry, to write stuff and throw it out, and write stuff and throw it out, and write stuff and throw it out, and then find something that works. So that ordinary is also not easy. We make mistakes, and we're disappointed, and confused, and embarrassed, or sad, or angry. But we also have the equipment to go through these experiences and cope and come through it. But like with everything else, if we don't use it, we lose it. And we don't get to solve our problems. So I wanted to share about a little girl who had a problem. Her name was Alice, and she went through the looking glass. And she finally wound up being able to go into the garden. Chapter 2. "I should see the garden better," said Alice to herself, "if I could get to the top of the hill, and here's a path that leads straight to it. At least, no, it doesn't do that." After going a few yards along the path and turning several sharp corners, "but I suppose it will at last. But how curious it twists. It's more like a corkscrew than a path. Well, this turn goes up the hill, I suppose. No, it doesn't. This goes straight back to the house. Well, then, I'll try the other way." And so she did, wandering up and down and trying turn after turn, but always coming back to the house, do what she would. Indeed, once she turned a corner rather more quickly than usual, and she ran up against it before she could stop herself. "It's no use talking about it," Alice said, looking up at the house and pretending it was arguing with her. "I'm not going in again yet. I know I should have to get through the looking glass again, back into the old room, and that'd be the end of all my adventures." So resolutely turning back upon her back upon the house, she set out once more down the path, determined to keep straight on till she got to the hill. For a few minutes all went well, and then she was just saying, "I really shall do it this time," when the path gave a sudden twist and shook itself, as she described it afterwards, and the next moment she found herself actually walking in at the door. "Oh, it's too bad," she cried. "I never saw such a house for getting in the way, never." However, there was a hill full in sight, so there was nothing to be done but start again. This time she came upon a large flower bed. Then there's a little scene where she and the flowers are talking to one another, because these flowers can talk. And then she spots the Red Queen. "I think I'll go and meet her," said Alice, for though the flowers were interesting enough, she felt that it would be far grander to have a talk with a real queen. "You can't possibly do that," said the rose. "I should advise you to walk the other way." This sounded nonsense to Alice, so she said nothing, but set off once towards the Red Queen. To her surprise, she lost sight of her in a moment, and found herself walking in at the front door again. A little provoked, she drew back, and after looking everywhere for the queen, whom she spied out at last a long way off, she thought she would try the plan, this time, of walking in the opposite direction. It succeeded beautifully. As bad as I am in mathematics, I understand that that was Dodsworth, the mathematician. He's talking about solving problems. He's talking about solving neuroses, about doing the same thing again and again and again and again, and getting the same consequence, the same outcome. Again and again and again until you decide maybe it's time to really do something differently. Head in the other direction. Take the risk. Open yourself to a possibility. But that's ordinary. Human beings have been doing this, you know, ever since somebody picked up a pebble and realized that they could take a chip out of it and make a tool and use it as a tool. being alive is everything that we will know. And if it's not outright difficult, it always requires work. When things are going well, we're working. When things are going poorly, we're working. But that's ordinary. It doesn't come with the push of a button. It doesn't come without engagement and things and ourselves working towards whatever's going on. Coping is an intricate activity, but we have to engage it. We also seem, as human beings, to deal a lot in polarities. And everywhere we look, we wind up doing that. But what we can miss, and what gets us into a lot of trouble, is that much of the time there's quite a bit of territory between the two poles. Between black and white, there are all the colors. Not every alternative is an opposite. But it's really up to us to risk expanding our vision and taking in that there are all the colors and that there may be different choices to make, and that's more difficult than just black or just white. Ordinary is who we are. The productive inventions that are expressions of our unique qualities and particular talents can only emerge and be with the support we have from what we know and do that is ordinary. And my last little story is about Professor Yehuda. I became a music major when I was in college, mostly because I had no idea what I really wanted to do, or much less why I was in college, except that everybody I knew was in college and that's what you did. So the chairman of the music department at City College back in the late 60s, early 70s was Professor Fritz Yehuda. He, during the Second World War, was a Hungarian refugee. As a very young man, he was a prodigy and had come to directing and conducting one of the opera companies in Hungary and very established, and then Nazification came and he had to get out and was fortunate to get out. Actually, the United States was fortunate because we got the cream of the cream of European musicians during that era. I knew him. We were very close to retirement. He was probably in his early 60s at the time. And so this man knew a lot about music. He was a conductor. He was he studied. And every morning he would come in to school early, and he would go into the concert hall and he'd sit down at the Steinway, and he'd put the New York Times crossword puzzle on the music stand, and he would practice his scales and arpeggios every day. And that's what he did until he was where he needed to be. You know, the fingers were doing what they needed to do. And then he'd close up the piano and go upstairs and fill in the New York Times crossword puzzle in ink. That was the ordinary that he had to do to grow and to do anything beyond that point. It had, of course, come to such a point of habit that he didn't have to think about what his fingers were doing anymore, which is just fine. So he occupied his mind in another way and took care of the crossword puzzle. And mind you, English was not his first language. But he could not have done any of the other things he did And he could not have engaged his talents. He could not have participated and communicated in that part of his life, in that part of his expression, without his willingness to embrace the ordinary parts of scales and arpeggios. And for him, the New York Times. So